The Letter to the Colossians, in a Nutshell. Written by Bart Ehrman. Read by Ken Teutsch. We continue in this series that explains each book of the New Testament in a nutshell by turning to the letter to the Colossians. This is a book that claims to be written by Paul, but as we will see in the next post, there are very good reasons for thinking Paul himself did not write it, but that it was written in his name by a later follower claiming to be Paul. For now, we are interested in the letter itself, its major themes and emphases. I begin by trying to explain the book in 50 words. The letter to the Colossians, allegedly written by Paul from prison, praises the Christians in Colossae and warns them against false teachers who urge them to follow the Jewish law, live strictly ascetic lives, and worship angels. For this author, Christ alone represents the Godhead and deserves to be worshipped. Here now is the fuller account of the main features of the book. Paul is in prison for preaching the gospel, Colossians 4:3. While there, he has heard news of the church in Colossae, 1:3, a small town in western Asia Minor, not far from the larger cities of Hierapolis and Laodicea. The letter indicates that Paul did not establish this church, but his co-worker and companion Epaphras, a citizen of the place, did, 1:7 and 8, 4:12. The news that Paul has learned about the Colossians is mixed. On one hand, he is excited and pleased to learn that they have converted to faith in Christ and have committed themselves to his gospel through the work of Epaphras, 1:7 and 8. On the other hand, he has learned that there are false teachers among them who are trying to lead them into a different kind of religious experience, 2:4. He is writing to address the situation. The author of the letter alludes to his opponent's notions, but does not give a detailed description of them, on the assumption we might suppose that his readers already know full well what he is talking about. He labels this new teaching a philosophy and empty deceit, Colossians 2:8, and counters it by indicating that believers have already experienced a spiritual circumcision, 2:11. Moreover, he insists that since Christ has erased the requirements of the Jewish law for believers through his death, they need not follow regulations concerning what to eat and what special days to keep as religious festivals, 2:13-17. These passages make it clear that the false teachers were advocating some form of Judaism, perhaps like the opponents of Paul in Galatia. But they also insisted on self-abasement and the worship of angels, basing their appeal on special visions that they had had, 2:18 and 19. This suggests that they advocated an ascetic lifestyle and possibly the ecstatic adoration of higher beings. Scholars have debated the precise nature of this false teaching for many years. In general terms, Paul's opponents were evidently promoting some kind of Jewish mysticism comparable to that known from other ancient texts in which people were encouraged to experience ecstatic visions of heaven and thereby be transported to the divine realm where they would find themselves filled with the joy and power of divinity. Such people were commonly ascetic, urging followers to avoid bodily desires if they wanted to escape the body and enjoy the pleasures of the spirit. If these persons were Jews, they may well have rooted their asceticism in the Jewish scriptures, and so perhaps urged their followers to keep kosher food laws, observe the Sabbath, and, if they were males, be circumcised. In response to these views, the author of Colossians insists that Christ himself is the fullest expression of the divine. In his words, Christ is the very image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. 1:15. There is little reason for Christian believers to worship angels when they can worship the one in whom all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. 1:19. Indeed, the other invisible beings are said to have been both created by and made subservient to Christ himself. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, all things have been created through him and for him. 1:16. Moreover, Christ alone is responsible for the ultimate benefits bestowed on the believer. It is Christ who has reconciled all people to God. 1:21 and 22, 2:13-15. When he did so, he destroyed everything that brought alienation, including the law, with all of its legal demands. 2:14. What sense is there then in returning to the adherence to the law? For this author, Christ destroyed the need to do so, and those who are in Christ can enjoy the full benefits of the divine. 2:10 and 14-19. These benefits, which are conferred only through Christ, include an exalted status that is already available to the believer. This author maintains that there is no need for physical circumcision for those who have experienced the real spiritual circumcision that comes through faith in Christ. Colossians 2, 9 and 10. Or for ecstatic worship of angels for those who have already been raised up to the heavenly places in Christ. 2:12, 3:1-3. Or for human regulations of what to handle and what to eat, which give only the appearance of piety, for believers in Christ who have a full experience of the divine itself. 2:20-23. Indeed, all that the Colossians have sought through their mystical experiences is already theirs in Christ, so long as they do not depart from the gospel message they have heard. 2:23. The Colossians are therefore to enjoy the full experience of the divine as those who have been raised to the heavenly places in Christ. 3:1. This does not mean, however, that they can neglect their physical lives in this world or behave as though their bodies no longer matter. Indeed, they must go on living in this world until Christ returns. This means maintaining moral and upright lives. Thus, the author gives a number of moral exhortations concerning vices to avoid: fornication, passion, greed, and the like, 3:5-11, and virtues to embrace: compassion, kindness, humility, and the like, 3:12-17. In addition, he gives advice to different social groups within the congregation concerning their interactions with one another, addressing wives and husbands, 3:18-19, children and fathers, 3:20-21, slaves and masters, 3:22-4:1. The letter closes with some final instructions, 4:2-6, greetings to the members of the Colossian church, both from Paul and those with him, 4:7-17, and Paul's own signature and final benediction, 4:18. But was this actually Paul's signature? That's what we'll discuss in the next post.